Well, good evening. Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Thank you very much for spending some time this Tuesday evening with us. And we've got a really packed show this evening, as normal. I'm just going to make a few introductory remarks before I bring Damien in, simply because, of course, I want to get on to the main part of the show and get your questions into play. But just before I do that, I just need to make sure that you understand this is not financial advice that we're offering here today. Now, the good news is that through the tie-up with Nucleus Wealth at whattheworld.com.au, you can access financial advice through that platform now. So I don't give it, but if you need it, then there's a platform approach there. Also, please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. It is being moderated tonight. This is at the 19th of January, 2021. And use at Walk the World if you want to get my attention. There's always plenty going on in the chat, of course, but that's a good way to make sure that I see it. Or if you want to use Super Chat, either to make a contribution to support the costs of making these shows, or indeed to make sure that your question gets to the top of the list, that is also available there too. So without further ado, let me go push a couple of buttons and see whether we can bring our guest in. If I press that one and that one. Whoops, try that. There you go. Hello, Damien.
Martin. Good to see you again.
Yeah, I think it's all working, I'm pleased to say. And thanks very much for spending some time with us once again. It seems like only yesterday we were chatting, but I think it was probably back in November.
Yes, yeah, late November. So an election or a runoff election ago, at least, and an attempted overthrow of the US government ago. Yes.
It's like blinked and a missed a bit, but it's still plenty going on.
There certainly is. Yeah, there certainly is.
So I guess it would maybe good to get a few introductory remarks from you before we get into the questions, but there are a load of questions on there as well. But let me hand the screen across to you and maybe just introduce yourself to those who may not know whom you are, although if they're on the show, watching this show, they should by now. Then I'll let you lead off with a few slides and then we'll go from there, hey?
Yeah, sounds good. So, so my name's Damien Klassen. I'm the head of investments at Nucleus Wealth and helped found it almost 4 years ago now. And we've got a recent tie-up with Martin, helping him out running some superannuation and some ordinary investment for him. So I've sort of spent about 25 odd years. My last role was at Schroders in their global quantitative fund. Also worked for a number of different brokers in Australia, and helped founded Aegis Equities Research, which was Australia's biggest independent research house at the time, sort of back in the early 2000s. So yeah, long history of running sort of either independent or money for individuals, and we're trying to do that through Nucleus Wealth and indeed Walk the World as well.
Yeah, and Walk the World has taken off quite well. There's a few people come your way, and a few more in the pipeline, hopefully as well. And I think we made the call last quarter that market exposure is going to be really important, particularly with low deposit rates and the fact that the markets look now as though they're props through some of their wobbliness, and there's been some upside momentum, so it was the right call.
Yeah, and I'll certainly talk more to that in terms of it's this whole part where the central banks are trying to get you out of cash and into higher risk investments and get that money out there, and so they're going to keep those interest rates low, and it's tough trying to get the timing right on these, but it is that whole part about trying to getting some exposure to what are lower risk assets that will suit your needs without sort of having to bet the farm, so to speak, and to take too much risk.
Yeah, I think that's important. And one of the questions I had beforehand, which you might want to sort of take down for later, is the idea of averaging in, right? In other words, just not buying everything at one point, but effectively doing it in drip feed. Wouldn't mind getting some thoughts from your experience with that approach versus the sort of the big bang approach.
Yeah, certainly. Actually, let's start with that one, because I think there's seen a few different studies on these types of things. I think from a longer term perspective, I think what works best is regular investments, and just and where you're not trying to time it yourself, but it just sort of they pop in and they get invested, and there's no sort of you know, the times you get it right versus the times you get it wrong, and you know, over a longer period of time will wash out. The problem usually comes when people have like this big lump sum to put in at the start, and look, the studies generally say you may as well dump it all. If you dump it all in it right away at the start, then you end up doing better on average. But what that doesn't capture is human emotion and this whole regret, what I'd call regret minimization, which is a part about saying if you dump it all in and the market falls 30%, you're going to feel a hell of a lot worse than if you put in 10%, you know, every month for the next 10 months or 20% for 5 months or something like that. And so you get some of the loss and you make some of the, and you sort of, you'll probably feel better about that experience than if you than if the market ran away. Even if the market runs away, you've at least got some exposure to it. So I guess the purely mathematical answer is dump it all in as soon as you can. But because markets do on average over time go up, but that ignores short term market movements. And you know, we've had a pretty decent little run at the moment as well. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit of a pullback, but before we go again. So I guess the answer is you need to do something that's going to make you feel most comfortable. And the one thing I would say is, not making the time frame too long. Is that if you sort of say, okay, I'm going to put in, 5% a quarter for the next, X number of years, that's probably not going to that's not going to give you the type of return you're looking for. Mm. You do need, at some stage, need to start putting more serious amounts in.
And that's really the point. You've got to be in the market to be in the market, right?
Yeah, and it's a lot easier than to sort of, drift in and drift out. And there's lots of capital gains issues and things like that that you can you take advantage of from time to time. And so and that's one of the benefits, look, I try and push with by having sort of separately managed accounts or accounts that where the security is held in your own name, that over a longer period of time, come the end of the tax year, we're looking at what are the realized taxable gains and can we sell some stocks that are down and switch into very similar stocks to offset net cap, tax issues and things like that. Because that's beyond just getting there's a valuation element to returns from stock markets about the value you're getting, but most of the returns tends to come from the dividends and the growth in dividends. And so to get the dividends and the growth in dividends, you need to be invested and take advantage of it.
Well, I will just pick up this one question, which is sort of tangential but spot on as well. This is basically, what should I do with my cash, right? Which is, of course, the big question, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the question always comes, the answer always comes back to looking at someone's risk profile, which is why everyone tries to avoid these questions. But let me do the general advice part, which is saying, for higher risk investors, people who can handle the volatility and have a longer time frame, then starting to get that cash invested in more equities and other sort of growth assets is important. And then for people though who have a higher need for the cash, they've got to live off those savings or they might have might be retired and need that regular income. You want more bonds and more cash within that, just to keep making sure that the portfolio is sort of steady within that. I think from the bond front, we'll get this into a little bit later, but we're sort of expecting, I don't think inflation is going to run away from us. Maybe we'll see so much government stimulus come up over the next year or two that inflation does get going. But at the moment, based on the government stimulus we've seen and what seems reasonable, it doesn't seem like it's going to be enough to get inflation going. But having said that, I think markets are going to have a little bit of an inflation scare over the next sort of 3 to 6 months, where they start factoring in Biden's doing a lot of spending. He's probably going to have some big infrastructure plans as well. And so for bonds, I think there'll be a good entry point. coming up over the next 3 to 6 months, I think, where prices are going to fall a little bit and yields are going to rise. And then we've certainly pulled back a lot of our bond holdings, and we're looking for a chance to sort of get reset in some of those as well again.
Right, and that underscores the need to actively manage through the cycle and as things change, right? So the thing I worry about sometimes is people sort of invest and then set and forget, and that's really not appropriate, particularly in the current environment.
I think there's certainly going to be, in a low-risk, low-return environment where interest rates are so low, yields on shares are very low as well, it means that what happens on the capital front is going to get amplified. So if you're getting a 5 or 6% return on your bonds, and similar return, 6 or 7% on your shares, then if you're holding those for 5 years, and you lose 10 or 20% on it, it doesn't really matter as much because you've actually made so much from your dividends or from your interest payments that net you're a fair way in front. But when yields are 1% and share yields on interest are 1% and share price yields are 2 or 3%, then that 10% capital loss or 20% capital loss makes a much bigger difference.
Mm, absolutely. Well, let's move on to talk a bit about Bitcoin. In fact, there's quite a lot of chatter about it, but this was quite a good one. Bitcoin is our silent protest, right?
Yes.
And there is a bit of that around, right? You know, all of this liquidity printing that's going on, whether it's an asset transfer or whether it's real liquidity, depending on who you talk to. But what's fascinating there is if you count it up, more than 25% of all of the dollars that have ever been created have been created within the last year.
Right. And we're now at using, I think it's 0.2% of the world's electricity is being used to mine Bitcoin. And for the transactions. So, and this is a currency which isn't particularly well used. Mm. I guess
So I was going to say, well, maybe what we should do just sort of to start with is let's just put this up. So this is the Aussie Bitcoin chart, right? And it's basically from November 19 onwards, right? And you can basically see the acceleration. And it's interesting, if you map the acceleration with the liquidity printing, there's quite a strong correlation, right? And if you also then map it with interest rates dropping, there's also a very high correlation. So it seems to me that the current rise in the price of Bitcoin is more than just a speculative bubble. It's more connected with the broader things that are going on. But what's your read on it?
Yeah, could I give you the long version of this?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, okay, so let me flick to some charts, actually. That's and I'll... because I think there's a couple of different parts to the whole Bitcoin story. Am I sharing or not?
You're not sharing yet?
Not sharing yet. Let me go back and...
It worked before, so it should work again.
Yeah, well, maybe... Yes.
Yep.
I think we're... We're there now. Okay, so... what I wanted to talk is... So there's one part which is the whole idea of this... blockchain versus Bitcoin, and blockchain is this idea of a decentralized store of transactions, and it stores every transaction, and so it's readable and it can be checked from multiple places. And so the technology itself is quite interesting, and there's lots of good solutions for it. Bitcoin itself actually has a lot of problems in terms of, I spoke about the electricity, that's probably the biggest one. There's a lot of problems in terms of the number of transactions it can handle, but there's other cryptocurrency that could do that. But I guess it's the important thing for people to realize is that Bitcoin is like your beta version of cryptocurrency, and there are some fundamental problems with it. And then you come back to say, well, what is money? So what do we want money to do? So we want it to be a medium of exchange. So we want to be able to buy and sell goods with it. A unit of account. We want to be able to know that if I'm going to do work, you know, what am I pricing my work in? A store of value. If I want to do savings, I can put that away. And then sometimes there's a standard of deferred payment, which is more about debt. But Bitcoin sort of started as a bit of a medium of exchange, but never isn't really used that way. It's a bit too volatile to be a unit of account, and so it sort of ends up being this sort of store of value is the key. And then in the long term, you want to be thinking, if you think Bitcoin's here for the long term, you need to be comfortable with the idea that central banks are going to be happy to have private money out there. And what I mean by private money is money that other people, that non-central banks are creating. And there's lots of other examples of that. And I've got a few up here on screen. So your Disney dollars that you get if you frequent fly points, probably the more notable one. So, you know, that's effectively private money that the airlines create. And so you have to rely on, and we've seen Virgin, you know, go into receivership in Australia and issues about, am I going to get my freaking fly points back or not? And those types of issues. And even, you know, strip clubs sort of have often print money that people can use. And so, and there's a long history of it. Like in the 1800s, you know, individual banks used to create US dollars to go into the US system. And it wasn't until, you know, various runs on banks and problems that they were having that they ended up creating central banks there to sort of manage the liquidity issues. So private money is not new. What it's tended to be is either run by individual corporations where there's sort of low, I guess, a relatively low trust value on it and relatively low usage on it, or it tends to end up in these problems where you end up needing to have central banks to deal with the problems that happen from not having the liquidity or the distribution or that sort of sovereign backing. And so I guess a lot of the benefits of Bitcoin are also where you sort of see these things start to fall down sort of over long term in terms of the money. And then the question comes back to saying, you know, central banks quite like, or governments in particular quite like being the people who issue money. And so are they going to want a competitor? And so Bitcoin sort of sits in this stage at the moment where it's small enough that it doesn't really affect governments or tax authorities at the moment. But if you get to the stage where large parts of the tax base are eroded because people are doing transactions in Bitcoin and trying to hide transactions from paying, you know, trying to not have to pay GST or other things or income taxes, that's where governments start to crack down on it. And you have seen a few examples in places like Venezuela or sort of failed countries where they are cracking down on trying to use Bitcoin because people are trying to use it to skirt the rules. And so, so the long term, if you're a long-term holder of Bitcoin, you need to be a long-term believer that governments and central banks are going to allow private money. Short-term, but it's that, what you said, there's the liquidity side, but it's also the story. And so on the short term, so there's this idea, where does all the money printing go? And that's certainly, you know, in my view, been very much the case. A lot of governments, and it's not just the Australian government, there's the US government about, yeah, just sending out a $600 check. And once Biden's in there, there's another $1,400 check probably coming pretty closely after that. You know, is that going to end up with a lot of people who are going to want out and rush out and buy Bitcoin with it? Yeah, there's probably a decent chunk of it will. But the more interesting thing is this whole idea of the story of Bitcoin. And that's the one that, you know, it's sort of this ever-changing story that sort of it morphs itself depending upon what people want. So, you know, at the start it was this idea about this anonymous, you know, you can go and buy and sell your drugs or your, you know, your hitman and all that type of stuff, and it's all anonymous online. And then it's like, well, it's actually not that anonymous. You know, there are transactions and ways you can sort of track through. You know, it's the idea that it was transactional, it was there out to buy things. And, you know, I don't think there's too many people you know, out using Bitcoin to buy pizzas or anything. You know, it's sort of ended up being this financial asset where people say, no, it's a store of value or a hedge against inflation. And I guess to me, the real strength of Bitcoin is its ability to keep changing the story and pointing at something else as one of them becomes, you know, less important. And one of those things is this idea that in a low interest rate environment, if you've got if interest rates were 10% and Bitcoin's paying you 0% to have it, then it's obviously less attractive to hold Bitcoin. But when interest rates hit zero or even negative in some countries, then all of a sudden Bitcoin becomes, on a relative sense, more interesting. And it starts to become this whole idea of, is it gold 2.0? And I do think there's been that story has taken hold, I think. And I think there's some of those price movements you're talking about is that people are believing those stories and treating it like it's a gold 2.0. And so if that's what people believe and that's what they do, then until they stop believing it, then that's how it will act. And the biggest one I've left till last is this idea of institutional involvement. Now, for my part, the types of assets I'm looking to buy are sort of, you know, the high quality. We only buy large cap stocks. We only buy government bonds and cash in sort of various currencies. And so we're doing the sort of safe, boring stuff. So this was never going to be something we'd play in. But even ordinary, places like your, your future fund and places like that, you would not expect, certainly, 5-10 years ago, you would never expect them to be putting money into this. The bigger guys still aren't, but there are some institutions who are starting to get involved. And basically the story is, well, if institutions get involved, then this thing's going to hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they're probably right. You know, if you can convince people to buy it, what's notionally intelligent people, running these big institutional funds, if they can be convinced to buy Bitcoin, then the sky's the limit. It's a question about saying, if you had institutional investors investing in tulips in the middle of the Dutch mania, then they could have probably doubled or tripled the price again from where it reached. So I guess I just want to make sure people though are not, there's some really interesting stories with Bitcoin and they're very effective. It's a very effective marketing tool in terms of getting it going, mainly because a lot of them, they actually need, people who own Bitcoin need real dollars. And so they need more investors to come in to actually cash out. But, you just want to make sure the long-term story matches up with the short-term story, and you're treating it as a trading asset, not as a not as something that has sort of, I guess, tangible fundamental value behind it. So yeah. Sure, let's open up to the complaints and the people tell me why I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of interesting observations there. The first is, of course, I can give you a set of arguments as to why there is no value hook to the value of Bitcoin other than sentiment, right? So there's enough people want it, right?
Yep.
But I can also give you the other argument, which precisely is digital gold, institutional engagement, it's a reaction to quantitative easing, et cetera, right? Mm. Those two polar positions, there's truth in both of them. Yes. My problem is I have no idea where on that continuum the truth lies, right?
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty that I see.
Well, I guess where I'm getting to, and especially with that whole private money part, is we could create DFA dollars today if we wanted to all is preventing that thing, we'll create it for a dollar. All that's preventing it going to $40,000 is belief. If we can get enough people believing in it, and maybe the cost of one DFA dollar, they can add that into the thing. I don't know. So I guess what I'm saying is, as long as the beliefs continues in Bitcoin, then you're fine. So as long as you think that other people are going to believe it, it's the classic, not what you think, it's what you think other people will think. So as long as you think other people will keep on believing it, then there's value in it. But once that stops, and if liquidity starts to fade to come out, I don't think liquidity is going to come out for 3 to 6 months at least.
Mm.
But then.
So the interesting thing is that it's the same argument about why a dollar is worth a dollar, right? It's about confidence in the dollar, right? So the thing that I think I'm coming to understand is that Bitcoin is not so weird as it first might appear, insofar that it is about confidence and it's about all of those liquidity things, right? And whilst the underlying technology is different and while it might be decentralized, and your point earlier on was, of course, originally it was anonymous. Well, it's not now. If you look at the Know Your Customer rules in Australia, they're actually very strong, right? So people are actually tracked and traced when it comes to Bitcoin now. So I am not sure how different it really is, right? And I guess time will tell. And that comes back, I think, fundamentally to your point about centralized control versus decentralized, right? Because the governments and central banks around the world will not want to lose control of the money supply.
No, that's right. And it wouldn't take much, like, you know, if there was a big terrorist act in the US funded by Bitcoin, and all of a sudden there was a whole push to, oh, we can't let this happen again, you know, let's block Bitcoin. Would there be, there's lots of those types of, you know, there's any number of scenarios like that you could do, or a seriously credible hacking event that happens with Bitcoin where it's shown that more money, more can be produced, or someone can steal or whatever. Yeah. It could lose confidence. No one with tanks and guns to defend it.
Or you lose your password to your wallet, and then like that guy, was it someone, I can't remember which country it was in, but anyway, he suddenly realized that he threw out a computer some time ago, right, with a load of Bitcoin. He's now trying to pay the refuse people massive amounts of money to go find his computer.
Good to get that. And hope that it's still working. Absolutely.
Let me just put this comment up, because there's a couple of interesting things in the chat. This is from Business Crew. You can't roll up to a random shop with Bitcoin. You can't pay taxes. It's like basketball cards. It has a market and people trade it. That's some truth, absolutely. I think, in that. Yeah.
There is absolutely truth in that.
Yep.
And so, actually, I must admit, I'll step somewhere where I'm not 100% sure of whether this really happened, but I guess what I'm thinking is, let's say an O.J. Simpson card, you know, might have been very valuable before he was sort of largely thought of being as you know, well, certainly went to court for murder of his wife, let's put it that way. Mm. And so, you know, there are lots of things like that. I mean, a baseball card is a great example. Like, it's worth almost nothing, the actual card itself, in terms of the printing value of it. But there's value in that people think there's not going to be any more of them printing. And so as long as you can trust the company that issued them not to suddenly work out, hey, just a minute, that Michael Jordan rookie card was worth a lot, maybe I'll print up another few dozen of them. As long as you can trust that will happen, then, yeah, you're good to go.
And interesting response there. If I work with somebody and get paid in Bitcoin, I don't pay tax. Well, you should.
Exactly.
Right. Yes. So the other point people should understand is that if you actually trade Bitcoin and you made a capital gain, you have to declare it.
Yes, that's right. And let's just make sure. My comment was that it's a bit like the cash economy. If lots of people are doing stuff in the cash economy, they shouldn't, but they can, you know, get renovations done for cheaper if they're paying cash or whatever it is. And that's the idea with the Bitcoin as well. And so you're always seeing governments trying to crack down on the cash economy and trying to work out how can we make sure we can see the money so we can then tax it. And that's the idea with Bitcoin as well.
And, you know, my perspective is this, and this is from Theta One. Central banks are trying to start their own. They are. There are massive numbers of central bank digital currency experiments, programs currently running.
Yep.
And, you know, some of them are just for testing purposes. But remember what China's doing, right? China is actually handing out digital currencies.
That's 300 million, I think.
Yeah, in certain cities. And of course, then you link it into the social score. You link it into the control mechanisms, and suddenly you've got, you know, the Great Reset happening, right? Which is, of course, one of the. You know, if you go back to what the World Economic Forum said, a cornerstone of it was the digital currency.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder as well with China whether they've got to be careful what they wish for as well, because I mean the idea with digital currency is you can track it. You can track every time. So if somebody wants to know, well, how did that person get all that money in China? You know, they've been a pious public servant, and all of a sudden they're a billionaire. The problem with that is, I suspect there's some people relatively high up in some of the parties that would prefer people didn't know where they got all their money from. So,
absolutely. And people are drawing, sort of parallels with tulips, or the Great Tulip Mania, or tulips, as Dylan then corrected. There is some of that, and it's trying to unpick all of those layers. The other interesting observation, and I interviewed somebody who'd run a survey quite recently. 18-point-something% of Australians have Bitcoin in some form, or crypto in some form. More than 18%, right?
Yeah.
And there's an interesting distribution there with a lot of younger people, but we're now seeing it sort of up the age range as well. So it's definitely not just a young person's sport anymore. So
absolutely, I've had calls just within mine, because I've done a lot of quantitative analysis and I've had a few podcasts myself on Bitcoin, but I'd say I've had more questions from ex-colleagues and sort of friends and relatives in the finance game about Bitcoin in the last 6 months than I've ever had, because they're getting it from their clients. There's financial planners whose clients are coming to them and saying, you know, you've got some BHP and some Rio, and how come you haven't got any Bitcoin? So,
indeed. And this is an interesting one from Anthony. He's no idea, do we get rid of the US dollar? It's been used by pretty much every criminal. And that is actually the point, right?
Yeah, that's right.
US dollars are not squeaky clean by any means. It is the reserve currency. And, you know, one of the interesting observations, of course, from a couple of years ago, that Mark Carney gave a presentation at Jackson Hole in the US, which was effectively among central bankers. And he was talking about the future of the reserve currency and what happens after the dollar, right? And, you know, he's making the argument, well, maybe it will be a digital something, right? Without being completely clear as to whether it was going to be a central bank digital something or something else. There are people arguing that the next replacement for the US dollar will actually be, you know, if it's not gold, then it could be a digital alternative.
Yeah, well, and there's probably, Keynes put forward Bancor as a way of managing flows between countries and trying to avoid some of the problems you get where countries trying to devalue, the competitive devaluation situations you get in. And there's a good argument for a digital version of Bancor. So,
yep, absolutely. And digital currency is the way everything is going. However, for non-first world countries with little electricity, could be problematic. Well, yeah, and of course, if you think about the fact you need power to be able to transact with digital, right? Just think what happened in the South Coast when all the power went off, right? Now, your digital currencies wouldn't have been that helpful at that point last year when we had the bushfires.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I guess I'm thinking I generally don't carry much cash myself anyway. It's all digital. And I think there's a lot of people like that as well. It's all just tap and go nowadays, especially with coronavirus. So I think there's probably that part I'll sort of sweep to one side.
All right, well, let's take the conversation a bit further forward. I wanted to show you this particular slide, which is actually the US 10-year bond, right? Mm. And the point to make is there, it's been going up. Not dramatically, but it's up quite a bit. And people are basically saying, is this the start of something? And does it give us an early warning of effectively trouble ahead? What's your read on that particular question? Have you got a thought?
Yeah, look, for my view, it's a lot of it is back to U.S. election and the amount of money stimulus we're expecting coming from a Biden administration. So, and the idea that if they spend enough, they can finally get inflation going again, and that's actually going to drive the next leg of growth. That's going to start us on the path back to normalization. Because it is worth noting, you know, even though interest rates have probably doubled, I guess, they're from such low levels and we're still sitting at you know, record lows. You can still borrow, the US government can still borrow at a little bit over 1%. And they're trying to get inflation to 2%. So they can still borrow at a negative real yield on a 10-year basis. So when we're expecting economies to normalize and go back to, more reasonable levels of growth and inflation, then interest rates will be much, much, much higher. So they're already at, we call it catastrophically low levels, but they're certainly at emergency levels where the market's effectively saying, we don't think you're going to get the growth. So, the big issue for rates is will we start to see this inflation? And it's been long promised. We had any number of, I can't remember how many there were, but a whole bunch of quite reputable economists following the financial crisis wrote a letter they all signed to Ben Bernanke, who was the chairman of the Fed at the time, explaining why what he was going to do was going to create hyperinflation and ruin the US economy, and it failed completely. So the question really comes back to saying, do we think this time they've got it right and they will create inflation? I don't think the levels of spending are high enough yet. And there is you know, a lot of it as well. Like Japan's been through this for 20-something years, where they keep, you know, you go through, interest rates follow the same path. They think there's going to be inflation, but then you know, the latest one fizzles out and they start withdrawing and they pull it back. So, you know, I guess I'm more interested in waiting till I actually see the inflation come through. And we are going to see what will look like inflation over the next 6 to 12 months, because it's basically a bounce back. So we it's low base effect. Inflation fell a lot during the financial crisis. If it's just recovering back to where it was, and we're just seeing some low base effects, certainly expecting that. So it's going to look like it, but will we get the follow through? I don't think there's going to be the follow through. And so that's why, as I spoke a little bit earlier, so my approach to bonds at the moment is very much that we're out of most of the long-term stuff. We've either sold our bonds or just sitting in some of the very short-term things that aren't going to move. And we're waiting for this inflation scare, which we don't think is going to be real. And we'll use that as an opportunity to buy bonds. Unless, you know, we are seeing massive amounts of spending at the time. It will come back to the levels, but the levels that Biden's talking about now, we don't think enough to get inflation going.
Yes, fair enough. And Dylan just made the point, Nucleus Wealth saying they wouldn't dabble in crypto makes me more likely to consider involvement.
Go figure. And I must say as well, I spoke as well, you know, the whole idea of the word nucleus is this core of investments that's your safe, secure, sleep at night stuff. And there's lots of other investments around that, you know, whether it be, you know, whether you want to invest in property, you want to invest in small cap stocks, you want to invest in, hedge funds, whatever it is around that, you know, there's certainly some of those that will perform well. Crypto for me, I just put that down more as more of a gambling rather than investment. And I'd put foreign exchange, is a similar type of thing. Sort of zero-sum game, and so, yeah.
And that's really the point. I can give you arguments on both sides of the equation, right? I just can't tell. I can't tell you which is right, and we probably won't know for some time. In which case,
But as I said, if you're gambling and you're happy to gamble and you know you're gambling, then it's fine. Just don't try and trick yourself to say you're investing. I guess it's a part of, if you go down to the casino and you say, you know what, I've got a great feeling about number 9 on the roulette table, and I'm going to stick all my money on that. I'll tell you, that's pretty risky. I don't think it's. And you go, and it comes up. You know, who's right? Me for telling you not to do it, or you for putting your money on it? And saying, well, if you're judging it by the outcomes, then you know, treat it as a gamble. Don't treat it as an investment.
Now, I've got another chart to share with you. This is the dollar index, right?
Yes.
Which I think is a very important thing to think about, because effectively, you know, if you go back to March, right, it was up at 103. Now it's down at 90. Mm. And this is important to understand, right, because Bitcoin and indeed many other currencies have a very significant relationship with, you know, the dollar and the exchange rate against the dollar.
Yes.
What's your read on this? And do you think it's going to go up, or do you think it's going to go a bit further down from where it is? And it goes right back to the Biden thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and central banks. So I think there's a number of different factors affecting it. One of them is the willingness of central banks to get out and debase their currency as much as they can. So which of the central banks do you think is the most likely to spend the most in order to get their currency down as far as they can? It's interesting to note the Australian central bank sort of came out and said, you know, we think the Aussie dollar should be lower, and we consider whether we're buying some. And that was sort of at 72 cents, and I think where are we, 77 cents now? So it almost immediately jumped. And so I don't think there's a lot of faith in the Australian central bank's ability to
get
the currency. I think within Europe, there's the thought that they're certainly going to try and spend money, but there's enough differences of opinion between the various different governments that they're unlikely to do the really massive amounts of buying back government debt that's needed. Japan's been at this for 20 years and it never really managed to debase its currency. So I think of all the currencies, the US is looked upon very much as being the one that has in the past been a leader in doing more innovative central bank things to get around problems. And so if there's a central bank that's more likely to debase its currency, then the US is probably the one. And so that sort of points to more weakness in the US dollar. The problem though comes from that is that the US dollar gets too weak and it really starts affecting emerging markets and other parts of the the world economy. And so it's a bit of a push-pull in terms of those. And the other problem is if Biden gets up some really large stimulus package, what will happen from that is that's likely to be sort of dollar positive in terms of the thought of inflation starting to come back and higher interest rates. And so, it's always a bit of an each way bet with currencies. But I guess, our thought at the moment is it's probably more likely to be to continue to fall. And with a few sort of things we're watching to keep an eye on for when it could reverse.
Right. And it seems to me that there's a bit of a race because pretty much all central banks are doing QE and all central banks are trying to sort of manipulate their exchange rate, right? So it's almost a bit of a race to the bottom and who's going to blink first. So the point is that our central bank's saying, well, 55 would be lovely, but we're at 77, right? Yes. And I've read some research that said, well, we might be up to 80. Now, that's going to be a real problem, right? Because it has basically an inflationary importation effect. Because costs and our sold goods abroad actually cost more, so that's not going to help.
Yeah, no, I do think as well that not enough gets paid to the longer term lags in some of the currency effects. So when people set up supply chains, and it takes a long time to push through, and so if the Aussie dollar is at 55 cents, all of a sudden there's manufacturing or services, it might be worth setting up a call center or employing some more accountants or more lawyers or something in your Australian offices. And then whereas if the Aussie dollar is at a dollar, you're probably firing people in Australia and hiring them in Singapore or Hong Kong or somewhere else in your Asian Pacific zone. And so, but they're not instantaneous decisions. So if the Aussie dollar, over the last 12 months has sort of, been down to 55 and back up to 77, it's not like you all of a sudden rushed out and hired more people or fired more people. Like, at the margin, there might have been a bit of it, but they do take longer times. And so while I think there's the first order effect of a currency moves and people reprice assets within that, the longer it stays at certain levels, the more you actually really start to see those effects come through. And I do think the Australian economy suffers from not being as competitive on a, with a 78 or 77, 78 cents. I think at a sort of 60 cents or below, there's actually a lot more hiring done in Australia. And so, but you need a sustained level before that ticks in.
And I'll just display the dollar there. This is the Aussie dollar, right? It's quite interesting. Just if you actually go back and look at it over a slightly longer period, right? Whoops. Mm. We were up at 110 back in 2012-13, and then basically we've been down. And 77, well, it's not as high as it's been there, but over the last few years, that's pretty much the tops. So that's a bit of a concern. And one of the critical things to think about is the impact with regard to our exports and how that actually supports the economy.
The iron ore price is a big input into that.
Yeah. Oh yes, and of course the point about the iron ore price is that the more than half of our exports to China is iron ore, right?
Yes.
And they're
trying to make that more, I think, by getting rid of the other half, as much of the other half as they can at the moment.
Well, I was going to say that's actually, we're becoming more and more of a one-stop shop, right? Because they are chopping the coal, they're chopping some of the other agricultural stuff. So effectively, we become more and more of a one-trick pony, right? the interesting question, of course, is what happens in the medium term, because, you know, would Brazil or would other that some of the other initiative, China's other initiatives, mean that they become less dependent on us? And does that then basically mean we get left holding the iron ore baby?
Yeah, well, okay, so iron ore, there's a number of factors at play there. Probably the biggest longer term one, well, there's two major longer term ones I put it down to is the amount of recycling that goes on in China is still very, very low as a percentage of the amount of steel. So in places like the US, I want to say 90%. I feel like it's at least 80%, but I think it's closing in on 90% of the steel that gets recycled. And a lot of steel, more steel than anything, goes into buildings. And so, they knock a building down, they use the steel, reuse the steel, and most new steel buildings don't use as much steel as the old ones. And so, you don't need as much raw iron ore. China's still at the stage where a lot of the initial buildings as they were urbanizing, it was basically knocking down somebody's hut in a village somewhere and then putting up a skyscraper. And so they didn't have that ability to recycle, but that ability to recycle is growing quite quickly. And over time, because of the Chinese population isn't growing, you're going to see that a lot of the building they're doing, now they'll be knocking down a building they built in, 1990 or probably 2000 even, and putting up a new one. And so they will be able to recycle a lot of the steel from it. So that's one important point. The other one is the urbanization side. So if you think about an urbanization curve as sort of going, you're starting and you're building up and you're going through this steep part, and then you're flattening out as you start reaching the peak of your population. In the middle of that curve, you actually go from building, you actually go to fewer people every year going into cities. And that's what's been happening for the last 3 or 4 years. So I think it sort of peaked out about 25 million people a year, and you're back down closer to 20 million people a year moving from the countryside into the city. And so the amount of iron ore you need is therefore shrinking, over time. And the amount of building you can see in China is just unbelievable compared to the amount they need. So they are still knocking down a lot of buildings and putting up new ones. In the past, I've likened it to, it's a bit like the Soviets with their, in the Cold War, sort of making all this wartime goods and sort of trying to keep up with the US. They had this whole production facility for these for wartime goods, and then when that finally collapsed, that was the end of the Soviet Union. And I guess the danger in China is they're sort of basically building their apartments are the source of this. Whenever they want to put stimulus out there, they go out and build a bunch more apartments. And their premier came out in 2007, spoke about an unbalanced economy. And how they needed to rebalance away from that. And since he made that comment, they've actually doubled the amount of building they're doing. And so, and not looking like changing. So at some stage they have to start winding back. And that's the danger for iron ore, is that it's just not going to last forever. But at the moment it's certainly happy days at the moment for iron ore producers.
It's 170 US, right? And hanging in there. And of course the other interesting question about that is who else might be buying iron ore, right? And there are a few other countries, India and Japan and a few others that it might be. But yep. China is by far streets ahead.
Yeah, that's right. And it's because of the amount of building they're doing relative to the population size. It's not only do they have a large population, but the amount of building they're doing is just streets ahead of any other country. And yep. So that's a part. And I guess some people talk about Africa as being, a place that could urbanize and the very large populations there and growing populations. And that's certainly true. The flip side is Africa's actually got a fair bit of iron ore. And so the question is, will they be able to source it domestically? And possibly the answer is yes on that side. And having said that, China's actually got a fair bit of iron ore as well. It's just that they use so much of it that,
And I understand that China is tying up with a few African countries to help them basically invest in iron ore mining, right?
Yeah, that's a couple of years away from that. And then Brazil's had a lot of problems with its iron ore.
Yep.
For anyone who's not sort of on top of the situation, basically the biggest producer over there, Vale, So it's basically Australia and Brazil, really, that produce a little bit in South Africa. This is for export markets. But Vale had a dam collapse, and then a whole bunch of people died. And then they came out and said, oh, I don't know, you know, mistake, whatever it was, and this will never happen again. And then a couple of years later, it did happen again and killed even more people. And so that sort of took a lot of production offline. They've had a big coronavirus outbreak that took some production offline. So, they've got really high quality, and there's big expansions that Vale is doing, but you haven't been able to see that because of the first of all these mine collapses and then the coronavirus. So at some stage when they all come back online, there's a bunch more supply there that will.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's just switch to another topic. This is from Vanessa. What do you think of Joe Biden's policy regarding lifting the minimum wage to $15? Will this policy help with unemployment?
Yeah, I do. I think it will. I think the past ones have shown there's a couple of cities in the Northeast where they tried it, and all the economists came out. Oh, sorry, economists from one side came out and said this will be terrible, and companies will go broke, and whatever, and the general result was actually the opposite, was that because a whole bunch of people who are very poor all of a sudden got a lot more money, they could then go out and actually eat at restaurants a bit more often and go out and spend that money, and so it was actually quite beneficial for profits of the individual restaurants. Wasn't good, but for the volumes of sales and the effect on the rest of the economy was very positive. And I think that's a theme I've come back to a lot, is that this idea, if you can reduce inequality, then that will help drive consumption.
All the analysis says if you can get a little bit more funds into the bottom end, in other words, people who are effectively going to spend it, that's going to have a much bigger economic impact than if you actually cut taxes at the top end.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think there's, from a company perspective, and this is the interesting part at the moment, from a company perspective, there are some companies that will suffer from it, and company margins have been fantastic. So as an investor, you sort of look at how well companies have been doing on their margins, and go, okay, we're going to have to take some of that back with some of these minimum pay wage rises. But as an economic good for the entire economy, it's the growth you're going to get out of that will far exceed any losses you get in the short term. So it's sort of a very much a short term negative for a longer term, or not even a longer term, a midterm gain.
Absolutely. Well, I would argue there has to be a bit of a swing back, because corporate land have basically got all of the cards at the moment, and most of the liquidity injections that have been thrown out by central banks. We have to get it back into the real economy.
And there's some very good analysis by some analysts just looking at this whole part about saying, well, if you've got effectively three different areas of the government, the economy, your consumers, your government, and your corporates, and the government gets out there and starts borrowing and spending a lot more money, and it takes a while for consumers to change their behaviour. In the meantime, the corporates are the real benefits of that spending. And I think that's the position we're in now, where governments are throwing lots and lots of money. People are still saving lots, but that means that not all corporates, obviously, but there are some corporates doing very well on the profits. Actually, I've got a chat on that. It might be a good segue into. Should I share that one?
Sure, why not?
Yep.
It's in there somewhere.
Yes, that's right. Share that one. Through these. So what I've got here, this is the US companies, just because it's nice and easy to see and a bit bigger. So this is what we call a forward line, is a blue line. So it's basically looking at what are analysts forecasting 12 months sort of like on a constant forward basis. And so you can see it had that sharp drop as coronavirus hit on the right, and then it's sort of bouncing its way back. And the red lines are showing you what analysts sort of forecast for 2020 and then 2021 and 2022. And these numbers are certainly, for 2021, is a key one now, had a big drop, but the fact that it hasn't fallen any further. So what usually happens most years is analysts are very optimistic at the start of the year, and they go, oh, we're going to get all this great growth. And as the year goes on, all that just goes down and down and down. But the 2020 year, 21 year, is actually looking pretty good. Like, and I keep seeing, and we've seen a big bounce back in the 2020 numbers as well. And, you know, as I look through company reports, more and more I see companies talking about sales are down, you know, 3 or 4% this year, but profits are up. And that's sometimes some of that's government stimulus, but a lot of it is the fact that they've really got through and ripped out costs. And, you know, I think every company, when coronavirus hit, had a really serious look at their costs. And a lot of them have overcooked it. They cut out more costs than what they need, and they're actually reaping the benefits now in higher profits.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, one of the issues there is that costs of debt is very low because rates are so low, so that helps.
Yep.
And pushing middle managers, particularly out of the door, is a bit of a sport at the moment. I'm seeing that here in Australia and around the world. Those are the more sort of expensive resources, so they push some of those out. They lose maybe some experience, but the fact is that the overall health of the business may not necessarily be growing top line, but it's sort of down in you know, how much can you squeeze. The question is, how far can you go on squeezing the lemon?
Yeah, certainly from a social perspective, you do need to take into account that you can't keep having companies benefiting at the expense of everyone else in the economy. Mm. And that's where we've been going for, you know, some time now, and it, you know, continuing to go, which is why, you know, that makes gives you more justification to invest in it. But if that keeps happening, then you start getting more and more radical political parties showing up, and yep. You'll end up with you know, it needs to be equalized at some point. You can't have one group the world benefiting the other, and especially when you've got a very small group of people who are running those companies, you will find politicians will stand up and say, I have all the answers.
Mm. Well, I just want to show you this chart. This is actually from the latest RBA chart pack, right? And just quickly, disposable income in Australia has gone through the roof, right? Yes. In the last little while. Guess why? Because of all the government stimulus. The savings ratio has gone through the roof. Guess why? Because of all the government stimulus and, you know, pulling down on superannuation and things. And if you think about the implications of that, right, as the stimulus is actually throttled back, the question I've got is, what's going to happen? How does that play out? And going right back to your question about the relationship between support for corporates and support for households and business and small businesses, a lot of the support that's out there has gone to the big ends of town. In fact, a couple of companies have now said they're going to actually not take the job keeper, they're going to pay it back in the top end of town. My broader question is, that isn't necessarily good news, right? Those sort of household statistics, because what it is doing is distorting once again what's going on.
Yeah, we spoke about this. Yeah, the question, when does capitalism return? It's sort of my question. Let's go with when for the moment.
Okay,
maybe next year we'll start talking about if. But I'm going to go the glass is half full at the moment. What we've effectively done is take away most of the bad parts of a downturn, and then add in all the stimulus. So we haven't seen the bankruptcies. If you don't pay your mortgage, your bank doesn't even have to, you know. You can just keep accruing that debt, and your bank doesn't have to say it's a bad debt. If you can't pay your rent, you know, you can't be evicted in a lot of places. And this isn't just Australia. This is globally. Bankruptcies are down, depends on which country you go to, but somewhere between 15 and 30% in one of the worst unemployment periods we've seen. So we've clearly shielded everyone from the negative parts, and then pumped all this stimulus in, which is a bit indiscriminate. So some people who need it got it, but also there's a bunch of people who didn't need it who got it as well. And so that creates those inequalities that then sort of helps to fuel the share market booms. And so the question is, when does that start to be withdrawn? At the moment, I can't see when it's coming. I think there's the first one, you know, back in sort of February, March, probably March last year. They were mostly put on for like 3 month periods, and then it got extended to 6 months, and then they got extended to 12 months. And so now we're coming off the 12-month anniversaries, and most are now, I think from my perspective, are looking at it going, well, the vaccine's almost here. So we've already had it for 12 months. What's another 6 or 12 months on the end of that? And that tends to be what's happening is these programs are just getting extended and extended. And so I don't think we're going to see what it looks like. I don't think the tide's going to go out for a while yet. I think it could be at least 6 months, could be 12 months before the tide goes out. And that's when you start to run into those worries and worry about bankruptcies and all these other issues. Mm. But it's a problem with investment overall, isn't it? If the markets are pricing these things and then you get to, you know, 6 months time and you decide, okay, I'm going to sit out of this one. I think the bankruptcies are going to pull the whole thing over. And in 6 months time, Biden comes out with a $5 trillion infrastructure package and it does get inflation going and then markets and profits are going to push on, then you've missed that whole rally. And so there's a certain part about trying to get enough exposure and keep enough protection in there that you're not going to be too upset. But walking that line is difficult.
And sort of in Australia, remember there's going to be an election probably later in the year, right? So you would think, my hypothesis has been, they'll continue to pump the stimulus through until after the election.
Absolutely, yeah. Anything you can put else until after an election is any hard decisions.
Now it's interesting. Sir Cookie has promoted himself to Sir Cookie. Sir Cookie Boy. But we'll touch a forelock and continue. I asked Tony this a few weeks ago. Does Damien see a few flash crashes before a major crash, and what could be the triggers?
Oh right. Look, the problem with, I think it almost needs to. If you want to see a crash at the moment, it almost needs to be a flash crash. The amount of liquidity out there, we're sort of caught in this. It's a bit of game theory, almost basically saying, let's say the economy needs more stimulus from banks, central banks, and governments, and I think it does. At the moment, I think the central banks and governments have a pretty close eye on what these markets are doing. And so, and we saw this not last, was it two Christmases ago, where the markets sort of had that, Powell was talking about raising rates, and then the markets had this big sell-off until he finally went, okay, no, I'm not going to raise rates, and maybe I might need to cut them again. And it sort of forced his hand. And I think that's probably what we will see in this case as well. If I'm right, that the stimulus that's out there isn't enough, is I think what we'll have to see is markets will have to have a little bit of a tantrum to get the attention of central banks to then say, okay, we're going to go out and spend more money, and to get the attention of politicians to say, okay, well, maybe we will do some more stimulus. Mm. So, so the answer is yes. But I think the flash crashes, they're limited in terms of scale. And I do think there's a lot, especially at the moment, there's so much stimulus bouncing around in government money, that whole buy the dip is alive and well.
Yeah, and the markets will just look to the central bank to throw a bit more money in, and on it will go again. I mean, yeah. That's why my own perspective is there will be a correction at some point, but probably not anytime soon. And the more that money is pumped in, the more likely it is that the asset prices are going to continue higher.
Yep, the unfortunate, we're all being forced into assets we don't want to buy, or forced up the risk spectrum, and that's exactly what central banks are trying to do.
So. Yep. Exactly. Now, let me go on to this other question, which is, I think, very important as well. We know that the CPI is a poor indicator. Central banks use the wrong indicators to gauge inflation. Look at your weekly bills, fees, insurance renewals, gone up in price. Now, there's a really interesting debate about what are we measuring and how accurate is the inflation rate and how is real inflation net going. And certainly in my surveys, most people are saying costs are a lot higher than they were. So there's something weird. There's a disconnect between reality and what the central banks are saying inflation is.
Yeah, I've got a chart. I should update it for the latest one, where I run over 20 odd years and I look at things you want versus things you need. So ice cream has had deflation, and fresh vegetables have had inflation. You look through, I guess cars have had the deflation, and some of the public transport has had the inflation, or your TVs lots of deflation in TVs and inflation in your electricity prices. And it's this part about, and I think that comes back to what a lot of what people feel is that half of it is that whole, I can't avoid the things that have inflation, I just can't avoid. Whereas the things that have deflation, you're saying, well, yeah, you know, what if I kept my TV for an extra year, I wouldn't really care. And so the fact is deflated doesn't really make that much of a difference. So there's one part for that. And then the other part, which is obviously the tricky part, is saying, well, when you know they make adjustments for the quality of goods within inflation, and if my phone that I'm buying is twice as powerful as the phone I bought 2 years ago, but it's exactly the same price, is that deflationary because the quality is so much better, or is it just normal inflation because you know, I bought a phone before and I bought one now. And so there's lots of those types of questions, I think, which you could see some higher inflation from. So that's the inflation side. That's the CPI side. And then the other part is the asset inflation. And there's a pretty good argument, which I haven't seen refuted in any way that appeals to me, that's basically saying, well, the inflation is basically there, but it's there in the assets now. So you can have, if money's going to go somewhere, it can either go in to try and bid up, you know, goods and services, or it can go into bidding up assets. And the fact that we're getting more and more inequality means that rich people got a lot of money, they tend to buy more assets. And poorer people, if they've got less money, they tend to spend less. And so, you don't see the same inflation in the goods and services.
Mm, yeah. And it seems to me that they've done some things over the years. It's not just Australia, but other people around the world. For example, taking the price of housing out and creating a quasi-rental, you know, proxy means that when rents are dropping as they are at the moment, that means inflation is lower rather than higher for housing, when in fact we know that's not the case, right?
Yeah, it's a whole bit. If you're a homeowner, then versus you're an aspiring homeowner versus somebody who's renting, yeah, absolutely.
So I mean, you can argue, I think, that it's a bit fixed, and in fact there are a couple of sites around the world who actually calculate the inflation on the old way of calculating inflation, right? And it's a lot higher than the way that inflation is currently derived currently. So it's interesting, because if you argue that the Reserve Bank is effectively using a conveniently low rate of inflation, it means that their target is actually all wrong, and that means they're taking rates a lot lower than they should. So there's an interesting conundrum there, right?
And keep going.
Yeah, I was going to say, and so this particular comment's quite interesting. Government forcing people into overpriced assets before they pull the rug out. Government creating the condition of real wealth transfer from everyone to the uber rich. Now, whether that's an official policy or not, the fact is that inequality is a lot higher than it was here in Australia and, you know, around the world. And it's a result of the government and central bank policy for at least the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, that's right. Central banks lowering interest rates, inflates those assets. I mean, the other one I was going to say is, from my perspective, there's also some good arguments in terms of CPI in terms of interest rate targeting, as trying to use something more like wages to target the what the right level is, with the view that if you're getting, say in Australia in particular, if we're getting inflation come through because the oil price has risen, then the central bank raising rates isn't going to do a hell of a lot to affect the oil price. It's something beyond our control. Mm. If we're seeing inflation come through because the Aussie dollar, Chinese yuan has moved the wrong way, and so our TVs or wages in China are rising, and so TVs are becoming more expensive or other goods are becoming more expensive, changing our interest rates isn't going to make a difference. Mm. But the factor it can affect is really that wage growth within Australia. And maybe that's a better target. And the issue is the wage growth in Australia has been terrible, and the high unemployment and underemployment is not looking like helping it.
Well, the Reserve Bank is forecasting lower wage growth and basically saying until the unemployment rate drops substantially, there's going to be zero wage growth.
So, yes.
Now, there's an interesting comment here from Smooth Operator saying the document is called Overdose, right? Basically, he's calling out the thing that is about supporting the banks. So basically, I would argue a lot of the programs and initiatives that have been done over the last year or so, and you could actually go back right to the global financial crisis, is about protecting the banking system and financial stability, right?
Absolutely. And I'm sure I spoke about it last time, because I speak about it every time I do, every time at every opportunity that I can. But you know, keep in mind that in Europe at the moment, if you're in France or Germany and you want to get a home loan, you're paying about 0.5% in interest rate.
Mm.
And the central bank will pay 1% to the bank that gave you that loan. So effectively, you're paying a third of the price, and the central bank is stepping in and subsidizing the bank that gave you the loan 2/3 of the value. And it's an incredible, like, and it's there so that the banks don't go broke, because they will go broke. The interest rates are negative, and you know, if they left it to markets and devices, then all of a sudden Deutsche Bank's falling over and ING's falling over, and there's all these major, you know, banking problems they've got. So it's not a market economy in Europe. And the question is that coming elsewhere? And I think for the moment, probably not. But if we don't get inflation going and we don't get enough stimulus, and I'm not convinced there will be, then quite possibly that's the rest of the world as well. We're looking at you know, what levels. And sorry, I mean, we effectively have it in Australia as well. I mean, we've got the TFF, the Term Funding Facility. So it's 0.1 at the moment. Have I got that right? Pretty sure it is.
Yep.
And so the central bank is basically saying banks can't fund themselves at a rate in which they will lend to consumers, and so we will fund banks for them at a rate which is 0.1%. It's below what a state government can borrow at. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. And with all of this stuff, right, if you look carefully, the narrow mantra of financial stability is like a purple patch through APRA, the Reserve Bank, the Council of Financial Regulators, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know whether you saw the Freedom of Information material that came out last Friday. It was late Friday, relating to the Reserve Bank, right? But there were two. The first was they were saying, well, you know, asset prices will go up, you know, if you 100 basis point drop over 3 years, house prices could go up 30%, right? Which is, of course, the Peter Tulip model, which doesn't take account of credit and the cost of credit and the fact that people are assumed to be able to borrow unlimited amounts. The other one was on this inequality question and whether, in fact, the central bank should be targeting the reduction of inequality or not.
And right, I didn't see the inequality one, actually.
There were three that came out on the same afternoon, right? The third one were related to the ASX crash. But the one on equality was really interesting, because that was hardly picked up in any of the reporting that was done. But what they basically said was, it's not proven, right? So, in other words,
right,
that they sort of ducked the question, because it seems to me that they're targeting inequality with all of the stuff that's going on at the moment. Supporting the banking system, it's supporting very much the momentum, particularly around lending. And as you say, they're actually even throwing cheap funds to the banks to make them lend. And then if you add on top of that, the other thing which was reported today was that those reforms that were on the back of the Royal Commission into the banking sector, right? Well, none of those have gone anywhere.
No, that's right. As the immediate announcement, when everyone was outraged, was, yes, we're doing everything. And then it's like, let's just backtrack one by one.
And I know. It's a bit crazy. It makes you wonder what it's all about. You know, I don't know whether I may have told you this, I may not, but you know, there's a book that I love called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And in there, there's a thing called the Shu Event Horizon. Right, and basically, it's a theory that says that over time, more and more of an economy turns itself into selling shoes and shoe shops, right?
Yeah.
And effectively, you end up with everything being shoe shops and selling shoes, and then the economy collapses, right? And then archaeologists visit the planet thousands of years later and see this layer in the strata of defunct shoe shops and defunct shoes, right? Because effectively the economy becomes so concentrated it collapses, right? I would argue that that's precisely what's going on with the banking system.
Yes. Yeah, well, I think there's a good, I mean, to put into perspective what's happened with the European banks over that time frame. So since they started this term funding facility, they're down about 50%. So versus the market that's up. So it's not a, you know, life support for these banks is not necessarily a savior for their profits. But the only thing I worry about in saying that for Australia is effectively the central banks there are giving the banks enough money to survive so they don't go broke.
Yep.
There's a relatively close relationship between Australia and some of its regulators, so Australian banks and some of the regulators.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I worry that maybe they will make it relatively profitable. But sorry, if you're avoiding banks, I guess if you're underweight banks, then yeah. And the Australian regulators decide that actually it's in everyone's best interest for these banks to be super profitable, then maybe it will be a good investment in the banks. But yeah, otherwise I'm trying to restrain myself from the whole problem with these banks in this reflation trade, as longer term bond rates go up, that's a really good thing for banks. Mm. And we've seen banks over the last few months rally significantly. And so if that happens and you do see the inflation take hold and these things, it probably is a good, there's still more in the banks. But if you see it reverse, there's problems on those. I see our drinking game there for Martin. I'm actually a bit of a Hitchhiker's Guide fan as well, so I won't add to the alcoholism.
No, well, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, this is where I show my age, right? I actually heard the first series of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on the radio in the UK when I was a student, right?
Right.
And I loved it right from the start, right? Of course, the answer is 42, as Otto says, right? And then, of course, it had iterations with the films and everything else. It's just such an insightful set of things that he talked about, you know. And while it was comedy, you know, I keep picking up these little jewels, right? Mm. And you know, there's a really serious point, right?
And he's a mathematician as well, which is, you know, he's got a lot of inside maths jokes in there, and a lot of them are accurately funny.
Absolutely, absolutely right. You know, and you know, people sometimes ask me, what books should I read? That's one of the ones on my recommended reading list, right?
Right. Yes.
Now, there was one question which I didn't get to earlier on because it wasn't quite appropriate from Donna. Donna, thank you very much for your contribution. Really appreciate that. I can't display your particular question, but I'll just read it out. At What the World, being a 1976 baby, I'm never eligible for the age pension scheme that Keating stopped in the 80s. I've been putting in 10% of wages into super. Will the government take it from me? Now, I wanted to sort of broaden that slightly, because clearly one of the big questions at the moment is superannuation contributions. The Reserve Bank's come out and just said, we don't want to increase the superannuation contribution because it will reduce wages further. And the question about superannuation, Damien, is what's the story here about how you prepare longer term for, you know, that superannuation fund? Because it gets ever more complicated now, doesn't it?
I could spend, we could spend a whole podcast talking superannuation.
Maybe next time we will then.
Yeah. And I'm going to sidetrack slightly, but I will come back to that question. But, you know, it's worth noting that the way we've set up superannuation at the moment is really more of a tax dodge than anything. So somebody who's on $20,000 and puts another dollar into the, if they earned that dollar and got it in their pocket, they wouldn't pay any tax. If they put it into the super, they're actually paying 15% tax. So it's bad for somebody on that end. At the other end of the spectrum, somebody who's on $500,000 and puts another dollar into their super fund, actually, you know, should have paid half of it, but they end up only paying 15%. And so, so we've got some inequality issues already in the superannuation. Having said that, that's one part. The second part is the whole cost of it is it costs more to run our superannuation system than I believe our army. So in terms of the amount of money that's being paid to investment consultants, you know, all the various army and ourselves, you know, I'll put myself there as, you know, we've tried to keep our costs as low as we can, but you know, really it's There's an incredible amount of spent on just the people doing it, let alone all the tax breaks we're giving to people for putting the money into superannuation. It doesn't look that sustainable if you look at it in a bigger sense. Ideally, you get the costs down, and hopefully, you know, we're helping to contribute to that. But you know, others will be along the same part, and you'll try and even out those inequalities so that maybe everyone gets the same everyone gets the same tax cut regardless of how much money you have. You don't have rich people getting bigger tax cuts than poor people.
Mm.
I do think there's a government backing for the whole idea that people should be at least responsible for some of their, and it will be a tax advantage. I think they'll find it very difficult to pull away the age pension. So I think in aggregate, you're probably going to be all right from that perspective. It's actually an interesting one because we're working on a calculator as well in the background. We're probably at least 2 or 3 months away from releasing this, but I'll come back on when it's up and running. Around this whole part about will you have enough money or not? Sorry, I've just swallowed a bit of dust. One sec.
All right.
Because the real thing you need to know is it's your offense and your defense. Is that it's very easy for people to feel guilty about every cent they need to spend. So you're sort of saying, oh, I went on a holiday this year, but does that mean I didn't put enough away for my retirement? Whereas what we're trying to do with the calculator is they can get it back to the stage where people can look and say, okay, I can see that on the balance of probabilities, I will have enough money to fund either an average or a below average or above average sort of retirement, and sort of pull a few levers as to if you want to put some special things in. Are you going to pay for your kids' weddings, or are you going to pay for their university, or are they paying for that themselves? And you know, a few things like that to actually come back to that idea of trying to give you a roadmap to how whether you've got enough money to get through or not, and how much these are affecting. But I guess the short answer is, if you've been putting 10% aside and you're on a reasonably high salary, you'll probably be fine. If you're below average salary or you've had to have some big breaks in your work, then you're probably going to need the age pension to sort of help.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the point is, though, that the assumed deeming rates and the assumed growth rates are way off where reality is at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, and some of the property values as well. Like, you know, if you have a retirees are heavily incentivized to buy property. So especially in more so in major cities. But you know, if you said, okay, well, you know what, I'm gonna sell my 4 or 5 bedroom house because I haven't got any more kids and I'm gonna downsize into an apartment, that's probably a bad financial decision for a lot of people. Because of all the extra tax they'll end up paying.
Mm.
And so in terms of actually having, you know, the right, letting a young family move into that's probably a great example. And maybe the people would actually be happier living in an apartment without having to tend lawns and things like that. But if it's a financial decision that's going to cost them a few $100,000 over 10 years, 20 years, there's certainly lots of issues with our retirement system that,
I think it's gone quite crooked. Just a quick acknowledgement to Smooth Operating Operator. Thank you so much for that contribution. It's really appreciated and will help to cover some of the costs of what we do. So thank you very much for that. Really is appreciated. And now there was a couple of other things that went on while we were just discussing that. Specifically, I just want to put this one up. I've got some bad news, guys. I don't drink. So I may have sounded a little tipsy while reading the news, but I actually don't tipple. So sorry, it's not going to work.
You don't have an excuse for it.
No. Yeah. I'm not sure whether I should be more worried or less worried, eh?
Yeah.
Okay, now we're coming up close to 9:26, and I know that Cookie Boy was saying we should keep running, but I think we're going to run out of smoke quite soon. But there are just a couple of quick questions as we sort of come to the end. The first one just relates to this, right? We know that deposit rates are lower than they've ever been, right? And that's true for term deposits and, you know, call money is at 0.00 something, right? And yet we've got more money sitting with the banks than ever before. Why do you think that is? And is that just a mistake, or do you think people are actually doing it for a particular reason?
I think there's a couple of things going into that. I think some of it's the inequality side of it. I think some of it's just the an extra dose of conservatism, given the events of the last year and seeing so many people out of work. I think there's a prices are high in a lot of assets, and I think there's a it's hard for people to see where do I put my money. I guess that's the idea of which is what I guess central banks are intending, is that it's that lack of obvious alternatives that's out there at the moment.
Mm. So. And the point there is that according to my surveys, more than half of the people with term deposits don't know what the rate on their term deposit is.
Right. Yes.
So my theory is it goes back to this sort of apathy tax again, right? The fact is that people actually don't necessarily think much about the returns that they might get. Just, rates are so low, it's hardly worth thinking about, right? But the point is that there's quite a big difference between the best and worst term deposit rates. The other point to make, though, is that even if you go into something like, what the world funds, you can go in relatively short term if you need to, right? So you're not committed to multi-year, are you, necessarily?
No, you're not, but I guess I wouldn't. Sure, I'd be nervous if anyone was looking for less than 6 or 12 months, I guess. Right. That's what I think. I think we've had a lot of housing deposits. I think that tends to be the most frequent reason people eventually take the money out is that, okay, I'm buying a house now. So from that perspective, but it's that, I guess, is the issue about going, well, if you do need the money in the next 2 or 3 months, it's pretty hard to go past a bank account for that money.
Yeah.
So you do need to have at least a more medium term perspective about investment.
Right. But that means, again, having a bit of a plan, right, rather than just sort of making it up as you go along.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's that idea about the having that, whether it's monthly or quarterly or whatever the amount, when you're going to be making those deposits and those investments, is keeping that plan up is really the key. Just saying, okay, I'm not going to try and, if once I've put aside, we spoke about at the start about trying to time reduce your regret on that initial amount you're investing. But once you're there, whether it's monthly or quarterly, don't make it a decision that you have to make. Oh, do I feel good about the market this month, or do I feel bad? Will I put in my savings? It's just set it all on autopilot and just let it go in. And some months will be good, and some months will be bad. But on average, you'll actually do better than trying to sit there and time it every month or every quarter.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's very hard to do that. And just to warn people, there will be a show coming quite soon. With, in fact, Tim from Nucleus Wealth, where we talk about the different modes of financial advice, right? Because it's an area that clearly many people don't get and don't understand the difference between directed and non-directed and, all of those things. So hopefully that will add a little bit more clarity to the modes of advice that's available, because, it isn't necessarily straightforward.
Mm. No, that's right. That's right. And getting that, I think there's that part about it's always a hard thing with super is that most people, I think about it as, I do want to spend a bit of time. I do want to sit down and just work out what I'm doing with it and work out how I'm going to put that money aside or where I'm going to put it or whatever. But I'll do it later. And I've got 30 years before I'm going to retire. And before you know it, 10 years has gone past and you still haven't got around to doing it. And so I guess that's what I'd encourage is that, speak to somebody. It doesn't have to be us. You know, we'd certainly love to have people have a chat. But it's a very easy thing for people to procrastinate and put off to later. And, you know, it's later comes way faster than you think it will.
Absolutely. And time passes. I can remember, it seems like yesterday, right, when I was actually completing my forms with regards to superannuation and pensions, because I was in the UK at the time, and it was saying, do you want to retire at 60 or 65, right?
Right.
And that sort of felt like, that's miles down the track, right?
Yeah.
And suddenly I was thinking the other day, wow, I've now passed that milestone. I blinked and missed it.
Yeah, that's right. And so, there's lots of other planning stuff I'm sure Tim could talk about as well. But, you know, it's the, things like life insurance and other bits and pieces that are easy to put off, but, worth sort of getting on top of at particular times of your life.
Absolutely. Well, look, I think we've pretty much come to the end of the show. There's always more questions that I could throw at you, but we could definitely talk for another 3 hours, but probably not. But come back on in a month's time, Damon, if you would, and we'll pick up the conversation then. I'm sure there'll be more things to talk about at that time. Let me just cover the other couple of things I wanted to highlight, and then I'll come back and we'll sign off with you. So just let me put the camera on myself, get rid of that. And just to say that next week we have Tony LeCantro on. That's actually on, I think, Australia Day, 26th, but he's going to come on. And Tony's going to talk, obviously, about some of the small caps, what he's thinking about goals and a few other things. That'll be worth listening to. So mark your diary on that one. Just to say that I'm running a number of one-to-one sessions with people at the moment with regard to property. I've got a backlog of spotlights to put up once I get round to recording them, because I've been doing quite a few of these over the recent weeks. There's a lot of changing in the property market at the moment, but if you are interested in a one-on-one conversation, you can still get that. Send me a message about 3 weeks out, just because it's just so busy. And I will just make the point again that we do have this this fund, the Walk the World Super and Walk the World Fund, which is powered by Nucleus Wealth. They do all the work. If you go to walktheworld.com.au, you can actually see the information there. And that provides you a path to get more information and also potentially to even tap into some financial advice. There are different modes of advice which are all there on the site. So if you are considering managing money, and as Damien said, it's quite complicated at the moment, this I think is a good option. And you know, we put this in play the last quarter because it was quite clear to me that this was going to be something which was going to be pretty essential. So I think that's pretty much all I want to say. Damon, I want to say thank you very much for you today to spend so much time on and being so willing to answer everything clearly. And what I like is, you know, you've got a lovely, straightforward way about just getting into it, which is tremendous. So thank you. Thank you for that. If you come back on again next month, that'll be great. I'm just making sure I haven't missed anything else. I'll put that one up. I think I've got everything done there. I've got a sort of a... I'm having comments rained left, right, and center. So thank you, Catherine, for your support. I can't seem to be able to put that one up at the moment. Oh, well, I can. There you go. Thank you very much for that. So I just want to say thank you very much to everybody on the show tonight for spending time with us, for asking those really interesting questions. And I really enjoyed some of the cross currents and the conversations. Damien, thank you very much for your spending time with us tonight. And we look forward to doing the same next month.
Looking forward to it.
And I think I'll probably just... I'm going to take you off air first, and then I'm just going to run the the final part of the show, which is just the outro. So there you go. I want to say thank you all very much to everybody. If I miss questions and comments, my apologies. If you want some specific follow-up, feel free to contact me via the DFA blog. I look forward to seeing you this time next week with Tony LeCantro. There'll be daily posts. And once again, just to say thank you to everybody who's contributed and helped and engaged with this channel to get me to more than 50,000 subscribers. I just am amazed. And I'm looking forward to the next 50,000. Hopefully, even more quickly than the last one, but who knows. So this is Martin North from Digital Finance Unlocked signing off. We'll see you next time.